Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, March 17th, 2013. I'm Christina Thomas. AETN, Fayetteville Public Library, and KUAF invite the public to a free screening of Wonder Women, the untold story of American superheroines. It's part of community cinema this afternoon at 2 at the Fayetteville Public Library. In this film, from Wonder Woman to the superheroes of today, representations of powerful women often reflect society's anxieties about women's liberation. Following the film, KUAF's Katie Henriksen will moderate a panel discussion about the topic. AETN.org/community cinema for more information. Ahead on this weekend edition of Ozarks, the history behind today's St. Patrick's Day celebrations, plus a hog farm moves into the Buffalo River area. But first, from property rights to abortion, Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis gives us a wrap-up of this week's legislative happenings.
During this legislative session, we have reported on a bill making its way through the Arkansas legislature that aims to give property owners a means of recouping losses in property value incurred by development regulations passed by a governmental entity. The Arkansas Municipal League and the City of Fayetteville have both stated opposition to Senate Bill 367, and this past week, the City of Springdale followed suit. The Springdale City Council approved a resolution stating opposition to the bill, and Springdale City Attorney Ernest Kate says that the bill has the potential to garner litigation against the city's planning and zoning regulations. He says that the bill's legal threshold of a 10% devaluation in property value is overly vague.
I mean, how do you determine that? I believe it would severely restrict our ability to do what the law allows us to do as far as zoning and putting regulations on the development of land, and it's just not clear. You know, and there's already federal case law on what's called regulatory takings. Regulatory takings is, well, if the city takes some action and it affects the property value of someone's property, then in some instances the city's required to pay that person. You know, it's in effect the taking of that person's property, and there's already federal law on that, and this just... I'm not sure exactly what the purpose is behind this bill.
Kate says that this bill could have an impact on any of the city's development regulations, including the proposed Interstate 540 overlay district that city staff has been developing for months.
If we pass the overlay district, if a property owner believes that by us adding this extra layer of regulation on top of all these properties, if they believe that it decrease the value of their property by more than 10%, then it could result in litigation.
Senate Bill 367 has been passed by the state Senate. The bill's sponsor, Republican Senator Jim Hendren of Gravette, has asked for the bill to be addressed as a special order of business before the House Judiciary Committee, but no date has been set for that hearing. Now that the Arkansas legislature has overturned the governor's vetoes of two abortion bills, lawmakers continued to discuss possible outcomes from the changes this week. In interviews with Talk Business Arkansas, Democratic Representative Reginald Murdoch of Marianna and Republican Representative Ann Klimmer of Benton further discussed Arkansas's 12 and 20-week bans on abortion. Murdoch says public opinion from some national news outlets have already referred to the state's actions as embarrassing.
The New York Post or New York Times, maybe, they put out a piece that talked about, what happened in Arkansas was shameful, that we're going to be in litigation and that it's going to be overturned and that, you know, that we're wasting taxpayer dollars. That's their view on it, as well as many others that think that we probably went down a road that's not legally correct anyway.
Klimmer disagrees. She says legal challenges are expected, but passage of the bans was a great victory.
This issue, more than any other, shows the real cultural divide in this country. But I mean, when I'm in Saline County, I mean, it's people are hugging me, coming up to me, crying, thanking me for running this bill. I mean, it is different, but we are not like the rest of the world, and I think this bill makes a statement.
Klimmer says that there have been conflicting federal court rulings on 20-week abortion bans in Idaho and Arizona, and it may be time to revisit the Roe v. Wade decision by the Supreme Court. Medicaid expansion is one of the big questions of this legislative session that have yet to be answered. On Monday, House Majority Leader Bruce Westerman told reporters that lawmakers are still weighing the issue in light of news they received nearly 3 weeks ago that the state could opt to use federal money that would have gone to Medicaid expansion to give the same people private health coverage. Westerman says lawmakers have yet to come up with a solid proposal, but they're working on something that might require co-payments or premiums.
I think there's some creative things we can do there that can provide good assistance to those who are in need of the health care benefits and do it in a cost-effective, innovative way that saves the state money, and the more people that are on the existing Medicaid system that we could get under this option would be better off down the road.
Westerman says that in the meantime, lawmakers will be meeting with an independent auditor to assess the state's Medicaid system as it is currently before moving forward with a decision on expanding health coverage in the state. The Arkansas House passed a bill Wednesday that would require all voters to show some form of photo ID each time they vote.
As everyone voted, cast the ballots for 51 yeas, 44 nays, and zero present to pass the bill.
There were questions as to whether the bill required a two-thirds majority to pass, as some had suggested it might be a change to the state's constitution. Speaking before the House, Republican Representative Stephen Meeks of Greenbrier brandished a list of documented voter fraud cases and told members that this bill does not implement a poll tax. He also said the state would ensure anyone who needed an ID would be able to get one.
This bill also states that for those of our citizens that do not have identification, that the Secretary of State will provide to them an identification that they can use from there in perpetuity. That'll be provided for them at no cost.
Speaking against, Representative Darren Williams of Little Rock, a Democrat, said the bill would make it harder for people to vote despite their determination to do so.
There are far too many people who are elderly, who are poor, who suffer from not driving and not don't have transportation, who may have a hard time fulfilling the requirements necessary to this bill to vote, though they are registered.
The bill, which has been amended, will now have to be approved by the Senate before it goes to the governor. It has been placed on tomorrow's Senate agenda. From the Herald and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
All kinds of farms operate on the Buffalo River watershed, and they have for generations. But a new industrial swine farm, the first of its kind in the state, is under construction near Mount Judy in Newton County. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, an unlikely coalition of opponents hope to stop it.
The Buffalo National River courses through a half dozen Ozark counties, a patchwork of wilderness and small farms. But west of Mount Judy in Newton County, adjacent to Big Creek, tributary to the Buffalo, an intensive swine breeding operation is under construction. CNH Hog Farms will house up to 4,000 sows, boars, and pigs in metal concrete floored barns. Perpetually pregnant and nursing sows will be confined to gestation and farrowing or nursing crates. After several weeks, piglets will be gathered in batch pens and fed until they reach slaughter weight. The barns will be washed out daily, wastewater piped to holding tanks, settling ponds, then stored in a large clay-lined lagoon. This so-called confined feeding animal operation, or CAFO, was permitted by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, ADEQ Deputy Director Ryan Benefield.
This is the first one in the state to be permitted through the NPDES program.
That's EPA Clean Water Act jargon, NPDES, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. In this case, more than 2 million gallons of liquid hog manure discharged annually, all of it spread onto surrounding pastures. New EPA CAFO rules were proposed in Arkansas several years ago. Notices were posted in the state newspaper, and 6 public meetings were held. The agency received a dozen comments, and a new general permit went into effect in November 2011. Then, last June, CNH Hog Farms was the first to apply to ADEQ for a CAFO permit. ADEQ posted notice on its website for 30 days. No comments were received because few people saw it. CNH Hog Farms owner Jason Henson declined talking on record about his business, but ADEQ Deputy Director Ryan Benefield said he will be held in strict compliance.
We designed the general permit that they're operating under to be protective of the environment regardless of where the facility is located within the state. And if they follow the terms of the general permit and their nutrient management plan, they should be able to operate without any effect on Big Creek or the Buffalo National River.
But Kevin Cherie, U.S. National Park Service Superintendent in charge of the Buffalo National River, says that the farm poses a threat. He first heard about the hog farm last December, so Cherie contacted ADEQ with questions and concerns.
You know, we're fairly convinced of the potential negative impacts that it could have on the water quality and therefore the concerns over public health and safety.
Kevin Tree was told that the state's new CAFO permit provides no exceptions for the Buffalo National River watershed. National Park Service staff routinely monitor water quality on the Buffalo and its tributaries, giving it high marks. USDA Arkansas Farm Service Agency, which is providing a loan to CNH Hog Farms, conducted an environmental assessment, and FSA listed the National Park Service as a cooperating agency. Not true, said Kevin Cherie.
Yeah, we were disappointed because we share a building we lease here in Harrison with the USDA, and no one thought it significant enough to notify us.
FSA's environmental assessment found the swine factory farm will have no significant impact on the watershed. Superintendent Kevin Tree and his staff shredded that study, contacting FSA in late February, documenting 45 mistakes. When queried for this report, FSA State Director Linda Newkirk said she'd not had an opportunity to review Cherie's complaint, so could not comment on that, nor why she included the National Park Service as a cooperative agency. Superintendent Kevin Cherie.
That it didn't raise a level of concern for anyone living within the state that's involved in this type of processing of paperwork is just it's discouraging.
In a letter of complaint to ADEQ, Superintendent Tree requested a moratorium on CAFOs be placed on the watershed until further notice. While ADEQ cannot do such a thing, the Arkansas Pollution Control and Ecology Commission can and has. In October of 1992, Randall Mathis, then director of the commission, at the time the state's lead environmental authority, ordered a 2-year moratorium placed on water discharge permits for any new hog and dairy operations on the watershed. Of 40 large hog, poultry, and dairy farms and operating in the region, half were found to be in violation. Plus, a new 500 swine breeding operation was in the works, just a quarter of a mile away from the Buffalo. PC&E Commissioner Randall Mathis also ordered a water quality study and monitoring program, which all led to stricter regulations and fewer farms over the years. That controversial moratorium also led to a legislative shakedown of PC&E a year later. Today, only the full commission, not one individual, can order a moratorium on agricultural permits. On March 4th, 150 concerned citizens packed the regular monthly meeting of the Newton County Quorum Court. Clinton Daniels, a cattle farmer and Quorum Court member, was there.
The Quorum Court is in full support of the hog operation.
And Clinton Daniels is puzzled why opponents don't seem worried about the impact 1.5 million annual visitors and hundreds of imported Rocky Mountain elk are having on the river.
And they stand in the water about two-thirds of the time in the summertime, so they're not too concerned about it either, it sounds to me like.
Lots of park visitors stop off at the Ozark Cafe in Jasper for a breakfast of eggs and bacon. Americans consume as much as 50 pounds of pork per year, on average. Michael Doherty slathers lard gravy over hot biscuits this morning. He's president of the Buffalo River Chamber of Commerce and has been fielding lots of questions about the hog farm just 15 miles northeast of here.
I'm hearing from everyone, and literally all day long, 50, 60 emails coming from everywhere.
Including recreationists and businesses that normally don't take an environmental stand.
And we're creating, and we just arrived at a name, we're creating a Buffalo River Watershed Alliance. And we're throwing down the gauntlet, working in a broad coalition to identify strategies that will manage these sorts of situations.
Unlike most watershed advocates, Doherty supports clear cuts of forest and herbicide applications to expand elk habitat on the watershed, a popular tourist draw, but opposes the factory farm. The Buffalo River Chamber of Commerce counts 60 members, including canoe and kayak vendors.
It will be the Pupelo. So we'll be floating down the Pupelo.
Seated across from him is kayaker Ellie Wilson.
You know, the smell of cow manure, horse manure, pig manure, that's the smell of money, but not in these kinds of concentrations. And if no one has ever seen or observed a factory chicken, pork, turkey, whatever, fill in the blank operation, I think they would be shocked, they would be appalled. People wouldn't see the difference in the buffalo the first day, the first week, the first month, but over time, all the runoff, all the contamination is going to change the river in ways that people can't even imagine.
Ellie Wilson was raised on a Texas cattle ranch, so knows what she's talking about. Still, she's going to work with the new alliance to block the hog farm. Among numerous small cow, calf, and cattle ranches on the Buffalo River watershed are 8 poultry factory farms. 6 are turkey operations, which raise batches of 30,000 birds, along with 2 20,000 breeder hen farms. These are not CAFOs. They're too small, but poultry ops are strictly regulated by the Arkansas Natural Resources Commission. And while ADEQ has control over hog waste, it doesn't regulate air emissions, which contains ammonia, hydrogen sulfide, and methane, a greenhouse gas. According to its permit, CNH hog farms will use odor suppression technology, but opponents say fumes from the operations place neighbors and a nearby school district at risk. Mount Judy School District Superintendent Richard Denniston disagrees. He says he's not heard one complaint about the hog farm.
I'm telling you, they wouldn't do anything to harm Newton County, the school. It's 200% welcoming a program that's going to bring more assessment to Newton County, which is one of the poorest counties in the state of Arkansas. It's going to bring jobs.
Agriculture is the backbone of the local economy, Denniston says. But so is recreational tourism. The Buffalo River runs free thanks to the Ozark Society, which staved off a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers impoundment back in the 1960s. That effort led to the National Park Service to survey this stream and designate it as our nation's first national river in 1972. Ozark Society President Bob Cross is an emeritus professor of chemical engineering at the University of Arkansas. He had no idea a hog CAFO had been permitted on the historic watershed.
Well, I was shocked that this was happening. I was disappointed that we didn't see it coming and weren't aware of even the possibility of something like this.
Bob Cross says he's sympathetic to the farmer in pursuit of a livelihood.
But in the broader picture, I think it's just almost out of the question that an operation of that magnitude should be within 6 miles of the Buffalo and on one of their tributaries of the Buffalo River.
National Geographic Society recently declared the Buffalo National River as one of the top 10 underappreciated parks in the United States, citing the efforts of Arkansas conservationists who championed protection of the watershed. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Good morning. This is Ozarks at Large for Sunday, St. Patrick's Day, March 17th. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown. She's features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Oh, shucks.
She doesn't have on green, and neither do I, but you can't get to us.
She pinched me.
Here's a quick rundown of spring break activities, because if you don't hit the ground running, you can't get everything done for spring break.
Okay. Let's go.
Starting Wednesday at the Bella Vista Library, a workshop called You Be the Author for third and fourth graders. Crystal Bridges has stuff all week. All week. There's a drop-in drawing on Monday, family flicks, introducing children to art and artists on Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. They're closed on Tuesday. Family-friendly gallery tours all of those days, drop-in studio on Wednesday at noon, drop-in improv with Trike Theater at 1 o'clock Thursday. Drop-in studio at noon on Thursday. Drop-in puppetry with Trike Theater on Friday.
Sensing a theme here.
Yes. Drop in and drawing, drop in studio, drop in to Crystal Bridges and do something for spring break. Hobbs State Park has a scavenger hunt all day Monday and Tuesday, all kinds of hikes, a camping skills demo on Tuesday. You can meet a box turtle at 3 o'clock on Wednesday.
You know, I still have never been to Hobbs State Park.
It's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these things start at the visitor center, or they can tell you where to go there. They're doing a story time with Dr. Seuss's The Lorax at 3 on Thursday to talk about the importance of trees.
Trees are very important.
Springdale Art Center, the Ozarks, has artwork by kindergarten through 8th grade students up all week. Adorable. The Jones Center in Springdale has a $3 spring break where you can swim or skate or both for $3. Monday through Friday, pool hours are noon to 7:45 and ice rink hours are 10 to 8.
I mean, that's practically all day.
Yeah.
For $3.
Not a bad deal. The Springdale Public Library has two spring break movies, How to Train Your Dragon at 2 o'clock tomorrow and Enchanted at 2 o'clock Wednesday. The Fayetteville Library has a whole week of spring break movies at 2 o'clock every day. Hotel Transylvania on Monday. Adorable.
Haven't seen it.
Peter Pan on Tuesday. Wreck-It Ralph on Wednesday. The Rescuers on Thursday. And Rise of the Guardians, also cool, on Friday. Terra Studios has mini workshops Monday through Friday, including making pinch pots and painting pet rocks. They happen at 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock, and it's $5 for each one.
I want to go paint a pet rock.
Well, we could sneak out. Who's going to stop us? Yeah. And the Ozark Folkways in Winslow has a juggling workshop from 1 to 4 on Tuesday, and that's $10. So go have a spring break blast.
That is a ton of stuff to do. All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. A first-time-ever lineup highlights a benefit concert this evening at Greenhouse Grill in Fayetteville. The kid-friendly show includes Shannon Wurst, Still on the Hill, and Candy Lee and the Sweets. It was Candy Lee who organized the Rise from the Ashes concert to help a family devastated by a house fire. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums recently spoke with her about the show.
The inspiration for this performance is a bit of bad news, actually, isn't it?
Yes. It's very bad news. Andy Kay and her daughter, Italy, have been big fans of my music and also through that have become good friends of mine. And when I heard that their house burnt down and that they had recently lost everything, I immediately started thinking of ways that I could help. And, you know, what better way to help than to put on a show and support them with my music, which they love so much.
And you've brought in some friends.
I have. Yes. I wanted to make it a kid-friendly show. Kids really seem to like my music, and I've always just wanted to put on like a real kid-friendly show with a few other local musicians. Still on the Hill are great. They write such great music, and they actually have, I think, a few kids' albums. And
perform as... Mm-hmm. Toucan Jam
they do.
At
they
libraries
perform it.
And schools.
Mm-hmm. At Toucan Jam for their kids' performances, and they go all out and, you know, have cool puppets and costumes and all kinds of cool things. So I really wanted to bring them out, and then also Shannon Wurst also had a kids' album. It's I can't remember what it's called, but it's like environmentally friendly
yes.
kids' music. It's really awesome. I've heard it, and I thought it would just be a really great way for all of us to get to play together and just support this member and this family of our community.
So you've got Kelly and Donna from Still on the Hill. You got Shannon, you mm-hmm. and the
Sweets. Mm-hmm.
This is going to be fun. This has never been this has never happened before, has
right.
it, with Still on the Hill, Shannon, and you?
It hasn't. And I'm glad that it's finally happening. I'm sorry that it has to happen for this kind of reason, but it's pretty cool that we can all get together and come together like this.
Have you talked at all? I mean, is there a chance that all of you will be on stage together?
We haven't talked about that. Okay. I'm not sure. We might have to think about it.
A kid's version of Sweet Jane or something. How those always end up, it seems. What are the particulars? When can people see this?
It's going to be March 17th, which is the St. Patrick's Day. It's going to be at the Greenhouse Grill starting at 5 p.m. We're not sure how late it's going to go on. We're thinking till around 8, maybe might end a little bit sooner. Since it is a kid-friendly show, we're not going to try and keep it going on too long. But it should be a lot of fun.
You mentioned kids like your music. Mm-hmm. You don't specifically write towards children. You
just
write for an audience.
I do, yeah. I just, write what I feel, and I guess it's kind of got that kid heart in the music. And it's fun. I didn't actually, when I started writing the music, think that it would become such kid-friendly music. But a lot of my friends, they show it to their children, and they kind of get hooked and end up singing along. So it's pretty cool.
St. Patty's Day night around 5 at Greenhouse Grill. If someone's hearing this and for whatever reason they can't make it, they can still help out?
Sure. There is, I wish I knew what the link was on Facebook.
I bet I can find it.
There's a donation going on for the family there, for Andy Kay in Italy. Also, I've been having people just kind of contact me personally on Facebook asking about how they can help. And there's also going to be a silent auction at the event, too, and people have been donating to that. And then people have also been donating clothing items, just various necessities of life that all keep us going.
Tickets at the door, or are there advance, or?
It's just going to be all at the door. Mm-hmm. All right. So it's $5 per person. Kids 3 and under get in free. And if you feel it in your heart that you want to donate a little bit more, you're more than welcome to do that.
Okay, here's a question you weren't expecting. When you were, say, 6, 7, or 8, did you have a favorite song?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I can remember that far back. I used to listen to a lot of Raffi.
Ah.
My parents used to play Raffi for me a lot.
And he's still out there.
Yeah. He's awesome.
All right. Candy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Candy Lee and the Sweets will perform along with Still on the Hill and Shannon Wurst this evening at Greenhouse Grill in Fayetteville. The Rise from the Ashes benefit concert begins at 5 o'clock. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Today is St. Patrick's Day, which got me wondering about who St. Patrick was and why the Irish celebrate him. To find out, I consulted with Tom Kennedy, an emeritus professor at the University of Arkansas. He's Irish in the sense that his family came from there about 4 generations ago, coming over in the mid-1800s during the Great Famine in Ireland. They settled in Ohio and Kentucky. Tom was raised in an Irish-American tribe. He began our conversation recalling a bit from his childhood and his interest in Irish history.
My father, at one time, in the great Irish tradition, owned a bar, and when he owned the bar, it was near the University of Dayton, and so he always had a big St. Patrick's Day party. And even when I was a fairly small boy, my mother would take us there for a while, I guess before I got too crazy, and I got used to that. And so, I sort of kept up with it. I've worked in Irish history and written on Irish history some, and I've spent a lot of time in Belfast the last few years. So,
St. Patrick's Day. Who is St. Patrick?
Well, I think we're fairly sure who St. Patrick was. He wasn't Irish. He was a Briton, and he came to Ireland early on. That is, sometime in the early part of the 5th century. Now, remember, that's about 430, 440, something like that. Supposedly, he was kidnapped by pirates, brought to Ireland, sold into slavery, and stayed there. Was forced to stay there until he escaped. And when he escaped, he went back to Britain and then finally over to Gaul, took holy orders in a seminary in Gaul, in Roman Gaul. Remember, the Romans are still very much around at this time. Determined that he would go on a mission back to Ireland to convert the Irish, who were at that time overwhelmingly pagan people. So he's the
Catholicism.
Convert him to Catholicism, right? Well, that was the Christianity mm-hmm. that existed. So he, you know, there's a lot of famous things about Patrick in Ireland. Supposedly he drove off the snakes. He used the shamrock, you know, the three leaf green clover, to illustrate the idea of the Trinity, you know, Father, Son, Holy Ghost, mm-hmm. three in one, on one leaf. And so those are the things for which he was famous. The celebration of St. Patrick's Day is for his death, not his birth, because I don't know when he was born. But supposedly or traditionally, he died on the 17th of March. And so that's how the idea of a day celebrating St. Patrick came into being. In Ireland, it was celebrated for a long time, a religious holiday. People would go to Mass. Now, I'm speaking about this is back 1,000 years. They go to Mass in the day, celebrate St. Patrick, and then take the rest of the day off, and they would be, you know, partying and dancing and music and drinking and so on. And that became really an aspect of Irish culture on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, so what's the deal with the shamrock? Why?
Well, I mean, the whole idea with the shamrock was, of course, it did illustrate. He used it to illustrate mm-hmm. a supposedly Father, Son, Holy Ghost, you know, three in one, mm-hmm. three gods in one person. It also is they developed the connection with green. Green is of course, I don't know if you've been to Ireland, but Ireland is a very green country. There's a lot of rain, a lot of green, and so the whole connection between Patrick and Ireland and green and so on. It's mm-hmm. from that shamrock, I suppose.
Well, so then today in Ireland, how do they celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
Well,
how do the Irish?
That's interesting. In the most of the 20th century, St. Patrick's Day was a holy day of obligation. It's overwhelmingly Catholic country. I mean, that is the Republic of Ireland. And so people went to Mass, but all the pubs were closed. And this was by law. A law that was passed in 1903, the Catholic Church had become sort of censorious and worried about over the too much drinking. Irish, I guess, are famous for too much imbibing. So, you know, for several generations, St. Patrick's Day was not a dancing, drinking occasion, except perhaps in private homes. It mm-hmm. wasn't a public event at all, which is very much different. Of course, the whole business of the parade is an American development. The first St. Patrick's Day parade was in 1762, I think, and it was by Irish soldiers in the British Army in New York who wanted to have a celebration and who had staged this parade. And that tradition continued after American independence. Most of the Irish who came to America prior to the middle of the 19th century were Protestants. Many of the middle-class Protestants.
Not Catholics.
Catholics were, by and large, stayed in Ireland. Most of them didn't have very much, and so the Irish Catholics took hold of this whole St. Patrick's Day event and turned the parade not just into a cultural event, but a political event as well. And it was, the famous connection with Tammany Hall, the Democratic mm-hmm. headquarters in New York, famous for corruption and so mm-hmm. on. They took charge of that, of the parade. So from about 1848, Irish aid groups like the Ancient Order of Hibernians united with other Irish aid groups and put on what now has become the oldest civic parade, I suppose, in America. In the United States, the whole idea of this parade spread. And it's interesting that the first town, the first city besides New York that had a considerable St. Patrick's Day parade was Savannah, Georgia. Don't know particularly why, but that Savannah followed, and then Chicago, Cincinnati.
Well, and then here.
Well, I guess they have one here, but of course the people who are engaging by and large are not Irish or of Irish extraction. It's just the idea of, well, let's have fun. Let's have a celebration, and that's what it's about.
I'm assuming then that Americans with the green beer and the green river, or that Americans then decided that you should wear green on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, not precisely, okay. Actually. There was a tradition in Ireland of Irish patriots. You know, Ireland was an English part of the United Kingdom, and from 1801 was united with England and Scotland and Wales in the United Kingdom. But there was always a strong underlying Irish nationalism. And one of the ways in which that was expressed in Ireland is, as they say, the wearing of the green, you know, that they would they'd put on green things and wear shamrocks and so on. So it's not exclusive to the United States, but of course now we have this tradition here, which has gone far beyond the Irish Americans. You know, it is kind of interesting. I didn't mention, but one of the places where they have a very large St. Patrick's Day celebration is in Argentina. Of course, there's an Argentine Pope, so I suppose that may have an effect on the celebration in Argentina.
Well, what is it? 40% of the world's Catholics are in South America. Isn't that what they've been saying?
That's right. Yeah.
Well, so today in Ireland, what's going on?
Well, today in Ireland, they finally figured it out, actually. The prohibition against opening pubs ended some part of the late 1970s. And into the 80s, finally, somebody in the Irish government figured out that it would really be a good idea to hold a St. Patrick's Day celebration to bring in tourists, because tourism, of course, has for a long time been a major source of revenue for Irish people and the Irish government. So in the 1980s, they finally got the idea of a great St. Patrick's Day feast and celebration. So nowadays in Dublin, they have this huge celebration where up to 1 million people come in, you know, and they have this giant. But they finally got the message, and so St. Patrick's Day in Ireland is the big deal.
Mm-hmm. Where does this like corned beef and cabbage, you know, like I feel like that's kind of something that people cook and eat on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, I'm not sure that's so traditionally Irish as it is Irish American, actually. You know, as I think I mentioned before, in the 19th century, up until the famine days, Irish peasants ate enormous amounts of potatoes. An Irish male, a peasant, ate, this is true, it's been 10 pounds of potatoes a day, practically no meat.
It's a cabbage, lot of potatoes.
potatoes, just you know, boiled potatoes. Cabbage, of course, is another very inexpensive, easy to get thing. So I suppose they did cabbage too. So I don't think corned beef and cabbage is anything that comes from the old country. I think it's more American.
Okay, what else?
And I hope people will have a good celebration on St. Patrick's Day, and I hope that I can celebrate it many, many years to come.
Yes, well, happy St. Patrick's
Day. Thank you, same to you.
Imagine never being alone ever again. Imagine sharing your innermost thoughts with your best friend, a robot.
When we construct robots, we are changing ourselves. We are changing what we are willing to consider a relationship.
I'm Guy Raz, the promise and the peril of our robot overlords. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, beginning today at noon here on KUAF. To continue our Ozark celebration of St. Patrick's Day, we've used it as the subject of this week's montage. See if you can recognize this collection of pop culture, Irish, and green snippets.
Ready, champ?
I've been ready for this my whole life.
Then you take us out on the field. Well, it's often, it's often in dreams I wonder.
Right back to that kind, it's a game. And I feel arms are hugging me. Just like she did, just like she did way back then.
Prices, hearts, moons, stars, clovers, and diamonds. Part of a complete breakfast. Oh, they're coming. I'll make a skateboard and glide away.
It seems you blend in with so many other things. And people tend to pass you over. You're not standing out like flashing sparkles on the water.
Castletown?
Could you tell me the way to Innisfree?
Innisfree? 5 miles and maybe a half more. Do you see that road over there?
Yeah.
Well, don't take that one. It'll do you no good. Now, the best road to Innisfree and many's to walk...
It's Innisfree you want. Be saving your breath, Mr. Maloney. Let me direct the gentleman.
The double deodorant soap.
The very one to get a strong man fresh. Look, and these green and white stripes are 2 deodorants to get a man fresh and clean.
What a fine fresh scent.
In the pool they told us the story, how the English divided the land, of the pain and the death glory, and the poets of old Ireland.
And in the end, the pursuit of the whiskey would prove foolish for the Hawk of Achill.
To see how you did on this week's St. Patrick's Day montage, just go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com. Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Katie Henriksen, host of Note throughout the week and on Sunday evenings, Sunday Symphonies. Morning, Katie.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Here.
It's Sunday morning.
I'm here. So what do we have tonight?
We'll hear the entirety of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, Opus 20, performed by the Orchestra of the Mariinsky Theater under Valery Gergiev. And this is the Mariinsky performing version.
So Swan Lake, I remember seeing like a ballet as a child. So this is the music.
Yes. Yeah. And it's one of the big, even people who don't know much about ballets, they know Swan Lake. The interesting story behind Swan Lake is Tchaikovsky was commissioned to write it in 1875, and he did. And when they originally launched the 1875 version of Swan Lake, it didn't go over well at all. It was not a hit. People were not happy with it. There's an 1877 premiere, and critics and people who just ballet goers, everyone was criticizing it. But now, you know, Swan Lake is now considered one of the main ballets. So the reason that is there was an 1895 revision of Swan Lake under new choreographers Petipa and Ivanov. And so once they revived it in 1895 in the Mariinsky Theater, which is actually where this recording is taking place, that's when it became really successful, and that was actually after Tchaikovsky's death, because Tchaikovsky died in 1893.
So it was the same music, but different dance moves.
It has a lot to do with the choreography, I think. I honestly don't know a ton about, it's a huge undertaking to have, like, a ballet choreographed and then the music to go along with it. And I am not well versed in how much interlinking there is between choreographers and the composer who decides to write the ballet. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, I'm definitely not sure what changed, especially. I think that they did have to revise. I mean, if they're revising the choreography, they're also going to change how the music mm-hmm. works as well. So.
Okay. Well, before you're playing symphonies this evening, you will be at the public library this afternoon moderating conversation for community cinema.
Yeah, it's an excellent project that I've participated in since August. It's a partnership between KUAF, AETN, and the Fayetteville Public Library. Community cinema, you get to have a screening of a documentary film that's playing on, in our instance, it would be AETN. And then afterwards, there's a panel discussion with experts in that field. And I moderate the panel discussion, and it turns really quickly into a conversation with everyone in the audience. So usually when you're watching a documentary at home, you watch it and you're thinking all these thoughts, but you don't have anyone to interact with or talk to about all these topics. This time you do. This Sunday is a really interesting one that actually hits home for me because I did a lot of gender studies stuff when I was in school, and it's called Wonder Woman, The Untold Story of American Superheroines. And it's going to be a movie about hits home for me because I remember in college actually I took a class and it was on pop culture, and at one point I wrote an essay about She-Ra. I grew up really loving She-Ra and thinking that she's so empowering because she's a woman superheroine. Then I looked back when I was watching She-Ra episodes in college, and she's always getting rescued by He-Man. And so I kind of wrote about this and how, like, even women superheroes are often being
rescued by the man.
So it'll be a really great documentary to watch and then discuss with everyone afterwards.
Do you know who the panelists are?
Not off the top of my mm-hmm. head. I know there's several professors in our area that are going to be mm-hmm. on the panel.
Well, and I think that March is Women's History Month. Mm-hmm. So that must be kind of. Okay, and that's the screening begins at 2?
It begins at 2, and then, some of the documentaries that are part of community cinema, the actual documentary runs longer than an hour. The formatting goes is that we screen an hour-long version of that documentary. So the documentary will run from 2 to 3, and then we'll have a discussion from 3 to 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, two chances to hear Katie Henriksen this afternoon and this evening. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Christina.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Some of the best regional watercolorist work of our time is coming to the University of Arkansas Fort Smith during March and April, when the Mid-Southern Watercolorist Exhibition is shown at the Smith Pendergraph Campus Center.
This juried exhibition includes 21 watercolors from members of the Mid-Southern Watercolorists. For more information, call the Campus and Community Events Office at 479-788-7300. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to see the hogs from the Chancellor's skybox? Or are you a would-be top chef looking for some instruction? How about a trip down the War Eagle River with an experienced guide? The Walter J. Lemke Department of Journalism's second annual online auction, Woo Bid Suey, is live online now. All proceeds of the auction are for the purchase of a product or service and are not tax-deductible charitable gifts. The auction supports the Student Travel Fund. Go to auction.uark.edu to place a bid. Is poor grammar giving your readers and clients a bad impression? Grammar Made Glamorous is a new approach to adding zing to your letters, blog, or business documents. This workshop from the Writer's Colony is tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the Holiday Island Clubhouse. For cost or for more information, 479-292-3665. Also tomorrow, the next AARP Driver Safety Program class will take place from 8:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the Fayetteville Senior Activity and Wellness Center. It's designed for drivers over the age of 55. There are no tests, and participants receive an automobile insurance discount for 3 years. For cost, to register or for more information, 871-9117. And Buffalo National River Partners invite you to stroll through some of the historic cemeteries of the Ozarks Saturday, April 13th, as local researcher and author Abby Burnett will be your guide on the event through the Carver Cemetery, the Hasty Cemetery, and the Sand Hill Cemetery. Participants will meet at 11 a.m. at Carver Cemetery. For more information, 870-704-9114. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Jasper. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Kyle Patrick Kellums will be back tomorrow, Monday, for an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. To close out today's show, we'll continue our celebration of St. Patrick's Day with an Irish jig played by musicians Carol Witter and Richie McCuster. They stopped by the Furman Garner Performance Studio earlier this week. Thank you so much for listening, and have a good Sunday.
Two, one, two.